The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the programme, you can email us, science at newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at News Talk Science. Now, before we get into this week's episode, just a quick note to anyone studying or working in STEM and passionate about communicating science in Ireland. FameLab, the world's biggest science communication competition, is back and open for entries. If you'd like to enter one of the heats or enter online, which you can do so, find out more at britishcouncil.ie. It's a fantastic competition with lots of prizes, including a VIP trip with me to the Cheltenham Science Festival. And that's the best part, of course. So check it out, britishcouncil.ie/FameLab. Now, coming up on this week's episode, the strangest creature that ever lived might just well be the Tully Monster, a fossil found 65 years ago that defies explanation. Half a foot long, it kind of looks like a fondue fork attached to an intestine. Maria McNamara from UCC will be telling us the fascinating story and explain just why it has puzzled scientists for half a century. Before that, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news as we do. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Dungan joins us back in the studio. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
It's alive!
I'm not. He seems pretty upset about it. In that movie, of course, Frankenstein. This is about creating a sort of a life.
Yeah, it's an unusual story. I have to say, the headline is extremely exciting, and when you look into it, it actually is really good basic science. But what's happened is, in the University of Vermont, they have done a study where they're creating what they're calling xenobots, which I have to say is in and around the coolest part of the story is the name. So they're not robots, and this is what it took me a really long time to discover. There's nothing in them that isn't completely natural cells, but they had a large computer, an artificial intelligence computer, go through a load of different shapes of what they thought could work for kind of new tiny little bits of life. And eventually they came up with a few different shapes, and then they got a microsurgeon to scrape embryo cells from a type of frog, which was called the Xenopus laevis, which is why they're called xenobots. And they then reshaped these embryo cells into little bits of life. So they kind of, I know it sounds so weird, so they sort of stitch them back together, almost like the kind of Frankenstein thing. And they're kind of like lumps, tiny, tiny, tiny 0.4 millimeter lumps of flesh. But because...
Are you sure you're explaining this?
No, well? I see.
Did you read it?
I did. And it took me actually so long. I read it for about 2 or 3 hours, and then I read the paper because it is actually really complex. But at the end of the day, all it is that they shoved a bunch of cells that were in one shape in an embryo into a different shape. And they're calling it this kind of life. And that what they did was they used skin cells, or sorry, they used stem cells, but they also used cardiac cells as well. So there are some versions of these tiny lumps of flesh, which are called xenobots, that beat, and they can kind of move around the liquid that they're living in.
Like, but using the closing and opening of the valve as a motor?
Not even a valve, literally just cardiac cells beating is causing them to sort of move a teeny little bit each time they
Gross.
Beat. So like they're talking about the potentials of this. So they're saying how these xenobots could take plaque out of arteries and how they could clean up microplastics in the ocean or oil spills and all these things. But really, at the moment, they're tiny, tiny lumps of flesh that just stay alive for a week or two and then die. Now, the one cool thing they did is they cut one of them in half and it stitched itself back together, which is quite cool. But I suppose it's great basic science. It's a really good start to what could be something amazing in 20, 30 years' time.
We're talking about nanorobots getting the Nobel Prize.
So, yeah, like, absolutely. And I suppose that's the important thing. These
drug
are not...
drug delivery, being able to use living cells to deliver or do something in the body and then for them
yes.
to die away naturally and dissolve in the body. That's kind of...
It is
cool.
Amazing. And that's the great theory of them. I mean, but at the moment...
I mean, it could actually revolutionize medicine if you know it. But definitely. It's not very impressive to you.
No, but it is. It's really
to
impressive.
To you, it's no big deal.
The thing is, this is just
Whatever.
Not what these are. They're not anywhere near that at all. But they could be, you're right. And they have designed one that has a little hole in it for aerodynamics. So you could make that a little pouch and you could put drugs into the pouch. But at the moment, they're not targeted to go anywhere. They're just sort of idly moving. You know, they're not... nearly as intelligent as we need them to be, but maybe they will be. So, you know, great basic research.
This program has never been about what can this actually do. The answer to almost all of those questions through the 10 years of this program has always been nothing.
Yeah. That's probably,
it's completely useless.
That's what we need to remember.
That's why it's called future proof and not now proof. If it's got now proof, we would be doing nothing on this program.
Very true.
Well, it's
very
science.
True.
It's not technology, right? It's
exactly.
Science.
And that is the big definition. And I get emails all the time from PR people saying, we've got this CEO of this. And I'm like, we don't do technology. Technology is 10 years after the idea, someone has managed to put it in a into an app to make people date and
buy things.
Data the robots.
Science has to start somewhere, so I'm not belittling basic science. It's a very good basic science.
All right, you know, I have loads more questions, but you don't seem like you want to answer them, so I'll move on to our second story, which is to do with the oldest material on Earth. And I saw someone tweeted this saying, I see Michael McIntyre is touring again, which is probably the greatest joke I've seen in quite some time. Oldest material found on Earth, but obviously it's not comic material. It's a different type of material.
Yeah, it's a bit of rock. Or is it? It's yeah, material. I don't know if it's rocky, but it's basically.
Oh God, this is going really well.
I feel
this week.
You should know that. I'm not trying to judge.
Well,
you,
I was like, I assume it's rocky, but there's just so little of it. I'm like, what? How small does a sample have to be before you can say it's not rocky anymore? You know, it's like perhaps it's only a couple of atoms. This stuff. So it's 7 billion years old, which is far older than the Earth, which is 4.5 billion years, and it's older than our sun, which is 4.6 billion years. So where did it come from? It's come from outside of our solar system, and it would have come at the heart of a meteorite. And this meteor landed in Australia quite a while ago, and some scientists in Chicago got hold of it, and they destroyed it. They pulverized this meteorite, and they crushed it up into a dust, and then they made a sludge out of it, and they attacked it with acid. And I know,
they
it's like,
hate this yeah. rock. They hate it.
And then they found in its core some rock that had come from outside of the solar system, and they were able to age it. And now the way they were able to age it, I found incredible. I assumed that the usual thing of using sort of radioactive decay wouldn't work here, because this is really old. And they didn't use that. They in fact used a cosmic rays as a way to measure the lifetime of this piece of rock. So they were able to say that it's 7 billion years old from this cosmic ray aging. So if something is in space, it's going to be bombarded with cosmic rays continuously, and the amount of bombardment will age it. So it's the longer it's out there, the more bombardment it'll have. And you can be signatures of this bombardment. I don't want to say that word anymore. And they were able to age it. And so they've said this is the oldest piece of stardust that we have. So in fact, you and I and the table and Lara and everything are made up of stardust. And that comes from when stars like our sun die. So they're sprayed out into the heavens. And they can tell you a lot about that the star that they came from. So this little piece of dust that came from outside of our solar system came from a long dead star. And so they're able to sort of retroactively tell you things about the star it came from, which is incredible, right?
Amazing.
Like 7 billion years old, and they're able to tell you something about the star it came from.
CSI space rocks.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Why do you get stories where you get to say cosmic rays, space dust, and pulverized, and I get ones where I get to say lump of flesh?
Because
that's your choice of words. True. It was true. Living robots. I mean, this is a really cool story.
You did give it a cool intro.
Jonathan, I was about to slag her for being a biologist, so you just ruined it.
It's because it's not slaggable, hon.
Yeah. So anyway, they've aged it, and they're able to say something about the stars it came from. But they've also been able to contribute to the wider discussion about the rate of which stars are created in our universe. It's thought that they're steady states. You're going to have an equal number of stars being created and dying at any one time. However, from all of the meteorites like this that they've found, they've shown that a lot of them come from 7 billion years ago. So that suggests that a lot of stars died, they ended their cycle at that time. So it suggests that the sort of rate at which stars are created in the universe is not steady state. It wasn't uniform. There was a burst of stars.
Pretty good.
That's cool.
Pretty good, actually.
Not cooler than my story.
Better than your story. Well, actually, your story was better, but he delivered it more.
Ouch.
Our third story, here we go, second chance, is to do with liver donation.
This is a cool story. This is cool.
So you're going to ruin it now.
I'm going to try my best to ruin it. So traditionally, when somebody passes away and they donate their organs, there's only a very small number of hours in which the organs remain alive. So it's different for different organs, but the liver, traditionally, it's about 9 to 12 hours that you have to transplant it. which is usually long enough to get it to somebody who needs it. But it's often you kind of want to try and keep it alive for a little bit longer. And there's this new technology which they've brought out. It was just published in Nature Biotechnology, where they can keep the liver alive for a full week. And it's not just cool because it extends the span where you could get it to another person. But the thing I think is the absolute coolest is they took 10 human livers that were deemed to be untransplantable. So these were from people who, when they died, the livers were just too damaged. And they put
kind of like that cheese in the back of your fridge.
Very, oh yes, specifically in my fridge. But this is what I think. Now, it's great to keep them alive for longer, but they took these 10 livers that couldn't be used, couldn't save a person, and they put them all into their soup. So they pump blood through it, they give it the right amount of oxygen, the right amount of nutrients. And a week later, 6 of those livers became transplantable. So they actually, see, this is exactly it. So what would have happened, say, for instance, when the person who was dying, they might have had maybe a big, like maybe a bad trauma that caused damage to the liver from a lack of oxygen. But from putting these livers into this sort of liver soup for a week, it actually brought them back to life. So it's not just about keeping them alive. It actually makes these livers usable. It's completely phenomenal. And 60% of them, so 6 out of the 10 became usable. Now, they didn't then transplant them into people, but they can. I just think this is absolutely amazing. All of the livers out there, so there's usually in and around, say in the UK, because it's a bigger population, there's around 400 to 500 people waiting at any one time for a liver. If you could save 50% of the ones that we thought we couldn't use, it is just absolutely phenomenal. Or if someone had liver cancer, you could take out half their liver that worked perfectly, keep it alive for a week, grow it up, take out the cancerous part of their liver and re-implant it. It's just, I just think this is absolutely groundbreaking stuff.
Livers are so cool.
Like, so cool.
Yeah, you can lose so much of your liver and it'll come back.
Yep.
Like there's no other organ that'll do that.
Well, so actually the other part of your liver
you
will grow to replace
back,
it. So it's not like, say, a starfish where if you cut off a starfish's arm, it grows a new arm. But a liver, livers are in lobes. And if you take out one or two of the lobes, the other lobes that are there will hypertrophy. So they'll overgrow to compensate. Mm. So they won't regrow the lobes, but they'll grow to fill the space and you'll get your liver back. Livers are amazing. They're the best human organ, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've read that Bill Bryson book, The Body, and my conclusion was livers are amazing.
Amazing.
Okay, our final story has to do with beards.
Yeah.
And I should just, quick point of order, our producer, Aidan Sports, say spectacular beard.
Woo!
And you have stubbly face today.
I'm just lazy.
I don't. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Okay, my bad.
So according to research, inverted commas here, Jonathan's stubbly face would be the most attractive to a random bunch of heterosexual women.
I don't think we need science for that.
I think right. We do. Let's get the evidence.
So this research was done in the US and it was published by people in Queensland in Australia. And they showed that women are slightly more attracted to men who have beards, stubbly beards, like Jonathan has. But they said that if the woman has an unnatural fear of lice, Or ticks or creepy crawlies or things like that.
What's an unnatural fear of lice and ticks? Didn't everyone have you mean fear or like they're a bit like a phobia?
A phobia, I suppose. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So that, you know, you'd really be disgusted by this. If a woman says she has that, then they're more likely to find clean shaven men attractive. Controlling for all other factors that...
I'm sure it sounds like they really controlled hard for
other
factors.
Oh, big time. There's 100 people in this survey, you know, like big numbers. Yeah, and so they looked at... I hope they're not listening. They looked at like strong jawbone. They looked at the separation of their eyes, prominent brow, which are seemingly all features of attraction. So, so you're probably good having a beard in terms of other people finding you attractive, unless... the woman that you're interested in has a fear or a phobia of creepy crawlies.
Now, often I ask this sort of knowingly as a sort of a tease to sort of talk about how we can actually get some useful science out of this. You know,
no, like, none of that.
What on earth is the driver for this research?
I suspect they're chasing an Ig Nobel Prize here, which is the alternatives to Nobel Prizes, which make you laugh and then make you think.
No, but the make you think part is what I'm looking for. What is the actual practical use of that information? Are they looking at attractiveness and what drives it?
You know what, perhaps, and you can imagine the likes of apps and things like that using this sort of technology.
In the drop-down list of what sort of person you're looking for,
attractive.
Beside GSOH, it is a person who doesn't have a fear of lice.
I kind of like the sound of these people who do have a fear of lice. I don't have a fear of them.
So like, I suppose they're trying to, like, well, there's loads of reasons why people might be interested in attractiveness, right? Firstly, it sells. So like, that's one marketing thing. But as from a scientific point of view here, I can't see any real reason why you'd need to understand that. Surely also people find others attractive based on more than their looks, but this is just looking at physical attributes.
Worst.
And it's only white people and it's just heterosexuals, so a bit limited.
Worst news round ever. But thanks for coming in anyway. All right, let's wrap this up. On the way, the mystery of the Tully Monster. Dragons, Sasquatch, the Monster of Troy. Human mythology is full of weird and wonderful creatures that never actually existed in reality. One theory for the origins of such myths is that they're based on the discoveries of unexplained fossils. But the Tully Monster probably trumps them all for weirdness, wonderfulness, and what's more, it is real. So what was the Tully Monster? Dr. Maria McNamara is a senior lecturer in the School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCC. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Maria. Before we talk about how we came across it, maybe you might first start off by explaining what the Tully Monster looks like, Maria.
Well, the Tully Monster is a really weird looking creature. So for want of a better word, it looks a bit like a worm, a kind of a fat worm, about 10 centimetres long, with a very long appendage sticking out of the front of its head that has a pincer at the end, like a crab claw, except unlike a crab claw, that pincer has teeth. And its eyes aren't actually located on its head, but they're positioned at the ends of a huge big bar that sticks out from its head. So it doesn't look like any animal that's around today.
The closest description I could form by looking at it and thinking about it for a while is like if you got a fondue fork and then stuck it into a bagpipe and then put a sort of a handlebar on it for the eyes. That's the closest I can. It's such a strange and completely unreferenceable sort of creature. If you're looking for a photograph, it's probably the best way if you can. twitter.com/newstalkscience. You'll see one on our Twitter page. But it I suppose because of this really weird physiology, it has really caused great interest. So when did we first come across the Tully Monster?
Well, I suppose we first came across the Tully Monster about 70 years ago in the mid-1950s. There was this amateur fossil collector, a guy called Francis Tully, who gave his name to the fossil in the end. He found these. He was collecting fossils from a pretty famous locality in the US, the Maison Creek fossil locality, where the fossils occur in little nodules, in little hard little balls of rock. You split them open and lo and behold, the fossils are preserved inside. And he had been doing this for years, and he started finding these. He was finding, you know, animals, I suppose, that were easy to recognize, crustaceans, shrimp-like animals, leaves, seeds. And then he started finding these bizarre-looking creatures. He took a specimen into the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, but the paleontologists who were working there had no idea what this kind of fossil was. They turned out to be actually quite common. They're quite common fossils there. And I suppose over the last 70 years, there's been a huge amount of debate about what kind of creature this was. Based on its anatomy, on its body features, we literally haven't been able to say, is it a worm? Is it something like a snail? Is it some kind of crustacean, an arthropod? Or is it an animal with a backbone? It just, its body doesn't have any of the normal features which we would usually link up with one of those types of animals. So, you know, pretty much we've been stumped. And there's been, you know, endless circles of debate. Oh, is it this or is it that? But up until the last few years, we haven't really hit upon any real kind of conclusive evidence for what kind of animal it is.
If you look at animals that have perfectly adapted to their environment, birds, sharks, any animal that has evolved and is still around today has done pretty well to work really well in its environment. when you look at this weird, oddball looking thing, it doesn't seem to make any sense from an evolutionary point of view. If you were to look at this animal and try and step back a couple of steps, you still find yourself nowhere, you know? It just doesn't make any sense.
The thing is, at any point in time, the animals living in a particular habitat, they are adapted to that habitat. Yeah. You know, so the Tully monster, for instance, when we try and work out what it was actually doing, you know, it has a very elongate, streamlined body with fins. So it was almost certainly a swimmer, you know, probably a good swimmer. It has, you know, the fact that its eyes are positioned out on those big, long stalks, that tells us that vision is really important to this creature, you know. So it, and in particular, it really needs stereoscopic vision. It needs to have its eyes giving two different visual images. And that's really important for depth perception. And that's really important for predators, for predatory animals to be able to catch their prey. And if you weren't convinced by that predator idea, well, it's got this really long grasping appendage with basically a toothed mouth at the end.
It's on a jointed arm, right? It's almost like a JCB arm with a pincer with teeth, which I mean, a pincer with teeth doesn't make any sense if there's not a mouth at the, you know, close to those teeth. Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is part of the mystery. You know, did the digestive tract actually start at the end of that long pincer arm, or did the pincer just kind of act to kind of grab food and bring it down to the mouth?
Right.
Located on the main part of the body. You know, we don't know. We don't know, and that's one of the reasons why it's so exciting. Because we look around us today, and we have a good idea of what an insect looks like, what a snail looks like. And yet in the past, there were animals around that didn't fit into these well-defined boxes. So evolution played, you know, it had all these kind of experiments, experimenting with different ways of making animals. Mm. So it's really interesting to see those.
So talk to us about the theories then. So we know it was probably a swimmer. We know that we have a good feeling that it's probably a predator. What else do we know from just the shape alone?
Well, you know, the shape alone, that's pretty much as far as you can go. People have, it has these, this kind of banding down along its body, and people have argued about whether those are body segments, like in arthropods and crustaceans, or are they muscles, like, you know, maybe some kind of, you know, fish, primitive fish, for instance. So in terms of the kind of very basic body shape, you can't say anything conclusive. And so that's why in recent years, the kind of arguments have really shifted actually away from the general body features and much more into what's going on in its eyes.
Oh, I want to talk about that in a minute. But what about this body of its? I mean, I've seen some pictures that have sort of holes along the side, almost like, you know, holes on a flute. Is that incorrect, or is that an interpretation, or does the side of this animal along what presumably is its belly, although it's difficult to tell when you look at it, seems to have these five holes?
Yeah, so there is a suggestion in some fossils of some kind of features located along the side of the body.
Do we see that in other animals?
Well, you know, you see features that kind of superficially resemble it, you know. So we don't know, for instance, those holes, are they gill openings like invertebrates, or are they some kind of spiracle, the kind of holes through which insects breathe? We don't know. We just don't know. The way they're preserved, it's not good enough.
Yeah. And I suppose we're used to seeing gills hidden, whereas this, it honestly looks like someone did a punch hole in a haggis or something. I mean, just going off the pictures.
So, exactly.
This is such a strange animal that just by looking at shape and where it is, we can only really say so much.
As
you say, that advances the science into a different direction. That's using chemical analysis, imagery technology, and other sorts of ways of looking at what this creature is made of, how it was built, and what it maybe fed on and did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I suppose, you know what, the really big kind of, I suppose, leap happened in 2016. There was a research group based at the University of Leicester, and they decided to take a closer look at the Tully Monster's eyes, because they're, when you look at them in the fossils, they look like just little black splodges on the rock. But they had a close look and they found that the eyes of the Tully Monster preserve these little granules of melanin called melanosomes. Now, for anyone listening who's been kind of keeping an eye on fossil dinosaur research over the last 10 years, these melanosomes, they're not news, because they've been studied for about the last 10 or 12 years in dinosaur feathers. And so we've been using them to actually infer what colors dinosaurs were and how they communicated with each other. But here they are preserved in the Tully Monster's eyes. Now, it turns out that that actually isn't too surprising, because, you know, some modern animals do have melanosomes in their eyes. We do, for instance. We have a black layer at the back of our eyes that's full of these granules of melanin. And they stop us from going blind, basically. They absorb kind of extra sunlight that might be bouncing around inside the eye. So they're really important to actually how our eye works. But what turns out to be really weird is that the melanosomes in Tully's eye, they actually occur as two different layers. There's one layer where these melanin granules are shaped like little sausages, and there's another layer where they're shaped like footballs. And it turns out that at the time, all of the scientific literature said that that was a feature that only happened in animals with backbones. So basically, in that 2016 study, the authors, you know, revealed that they had the first, you know, I suppose, proof that the Tully Monster was in fact a vertebrate because of these granules in its eyes.
So that would rule out things like squid and cuttlefish and insects.
Yeah, it would rule out everything like, you know, squid, cuttlefish, insects, crustaceans, snails, mollusks, worms. It rules out all of those options. It really narrows things down.
And if it's a swimmer, it's pointing really towards a fish.
Yeah, some kind of, you know, primitive fishy-like creature. Yeah, exactly. So basically, you know, the paleontology world was pretty rocked by this notion that here we have proof that the Tully Monster is in fact a vertebrate, flying in the face of all of these theories which had been, you know, circulating for decades. And we read that paper with, you know, a huge amount of interest. And then we realized that actually it was based, that interpretation of Tully being a vertebrate was based on one idea and one idea only. And that was that animals with backbones are the only creatures whose eyes have those layers of melanosomes. Mm. So we said, we went back and we checked the scientific literature ourselves. We read all of these papers dating back to the 40s and the 20s, you know, going back nearly 100 years. And we realized that it had never been studied properly in animals outside vertebrates. So we decided that we'd
give it a go.
We said we'd give it a go for the crack. Let's get ourselves some octopus, some squid, some cuttlefish, have a look at their eyes and see what's going on. And we picked those particular animals because it's been known for years that they've quite complex vision. They have quite complex camera style eyes, like our eyes. So we said, if we're going to find melanin anywhere, should we find it in them? So we got their eyes, brought them back to the lab, cut them up, and we did some chemical tests, and we found that their eyes are a chock-a-block full of melanin. What was thought to be some other pigment called an ommatin, it actually is melanin. All those old studies from the like 1900s, they were wrong. So animals that are not vertebrates have melanin in their eyes. And more than that, when we looked at the eyes with like really fancy electron microscopes, where you can look at really, really tiny details, we saw that the melanin in the squids and the cuttlefish is arranged in layers as well, just like we have in vertebrates and just like you have in Tully Monstrum. So that means that the Tully Monster, that evidence that it's a vertebrate, actually doesn't stand up. It doesn't stand up to kind of deeper scrutiny. So we realized at that point that, you know, we were selling a kind of a sad story, you know, oh, sorry, actually, we were wrong. You know, scientists were wrong. Tully Monstrum isn't a vertebrate after all. We should have studied modern animals a bit better before, you know, coming up with those conclusions. So we decided, we wondered, you know, is that it? Is that the end of the story?
Yeah, because if it ends there, essentially what you've done is you've added clarity to a detail, but added more confusion to the overall story.
Yeah,
so you've instead of putting us one pace forward, technically we've taken two steps back.
Yeah, exactly. But it's better to be aware of the limitations of what you're doing than be wrong, you know.
No, absolutely.
But we wanted to actually see, could we get closer to the truth? So for the last few years, we've been analysing the chemistry of melanin from all different types of modern and fossil creatures. And we said, well, why not look at the chemistry of the melanin in the Tully Monster and in vertebrate eyes and the eyes of our squids and cuttlefish and octopus? So we took them off to the particle accelerator that's at Stanford University in California.
What?
We took our samples, we took our fossils and our modern samples to this particle accelerator.
That fires subatomic particles?
So what it does is you take these big giant magnets and you kind of pull off some of your electrons, and they then smash into your fossils really, really fast. And they smash into your fossils so quickly that they produce a load of X-rays. And then we can use those X-rays to actually tell what the chemistry of our material is.
Wow.
So it's a really cool way of doing chemical tests.
I'd never heard of using this sort of technology in paleontology. I was always talking to guests about it in terms of understanding how the universe has worked,
the Big Bang,
the standard model, and all that sort of stuff. I didn't realize we could use this in paleontology. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. We analyzed the chemistry of our melanin granules anyway, of our melanosomes. And we found that when we look at our vertebrates, we brought some fish eyes and things like that, and their chemistry is all pretty similar. We looked at our squids and cuttlefish and octopus, and their chemistry is all pretty similar, but it's different to the vertebrates. So there is a chemical difference in the melanin between, depending on whether you have or don't have a backbone. So we said, right, that's really exciting. Let's actually see, does it hold up with fossils? So we analysed a bunch of fossils from the same place where the Tully Monster is from the Maison Creek Formation. And we found that the animals with and without backbones, the chemistry of the melanin was different, and it was different in the same way to what we saw in the modern animals. So it all boils down to how much copper and how much zinc you have. You know, the vertebrates have more of one and the invertebrates have more of the other. So then we said, right, we've got a really nice chemical difference here. Where does Tully Monstrum sit? And when we looked at the chemistry of the melanosomes in the Tully Monster's eyes.
Wait, just want to create a bit of tension. Okay, you can go.
It actually looks more like an animal without a backbone.
Ah, so not a vertebrate, not an animal, not a fish, but something squiddy, squelchy.
I have to be a little bit careful here. Like, granted, we were looking at modern squids and cuttlefish, but we're just using those as an example of an animal that doesn't have a backbone. We're not saying that Tully Monster is a squid. It looks nothing like a squid. It doesn't have arms, for instance. You know, its body isn't anything like a squid or a cuttlefish. But what we are seeing is that its eye chemistry, it doesn't make sense as a vertebrate. It doesn't look like a vertebrate eye in terms of the chemistry. So it's got to be, it's much more likely to be an invertebrate animal.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Dr. Maria McNamara, Senior Lecturer in the School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCC. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you haven't seen a picture of the Tully Monster, do just Google it or check out our Twitter page, twitter.com/newstalkscience, because it's something you just have to see to believe, because how that creature existed is beyond me. I know Maria was saying it must have adapted to its environment because that's how evolution works. And she's completely right. It just, I feel like, you know, I'm looking at it going, nah. Computer says no. Right, it's time to look back at your emails and tweets from last week. And we were talking about research where scientists put 3D glasses on cuttlefish, which are kind of like squid-like creatures, to try and understand if they know depth perception. Susan in Sligo says, do people really get paid to put spectacles on cuttlefish? extraordinary research. What's the purpose? Well, we did cover that, so maybe you could just call it the tail end of it, Susan. But the idea is that they wanted to understand the evolution of these extraordinary eyes that cuttlefish have, which sort of move independently of one another. Terry says, read 3D vision. Would it not have been easier to do the experiment with a chameleon? Something that I thought about, actually, because they have those mad things. I don't know if they are separated in the brain differently, or I'm not quite sure.
Because, I think they wanted to see, because the cephalopods are all on a different line, completely different line to us, and they're the only other ones on a different line to have a brain that's, you know, quite advanced. I think they wanted to see if it was the same on a different line.
Evolution, yes. I think it was an evolutionary reason that they studied that. Another says, re-cuttlefish, horses measure distance and focus by moving their head up and down as the eyes are on the side of their head. Oh, thanks, Susan. Regarding vertical farms, we talked to a guy, Connor McGann from Plenty, and he was talking about his vertical farm, which is essentially large racks where you can grow seeds and plants essentially to perfect conditions in an intensive way that's free from bacteria, free from pesticides, free from, bugs and all that sort of stuff. One person says, fascinating farming innovation, but pity about the obnoxious trend of young people artificially generating American accents also. Ugh. Well, I think if you live in America for a long time, he worked in NASA, he's been based in America for a long time. Like, I have to say, I pick up an accent really, really quickly. I've always been slagged for it. I presume you're not just talking about him, you're talking about me. Like, I've got other things to worry about, but thanks very much for the comment. Danny in Fairhouse says, this guy's an absolute waffler. What? I don't know. Look, check it out. Plenty.com. And this is not, I feel weird because it's a commercial thing. We normally talk about science. But check it out. I think it's a fascinating development. I think it could prove to be a really interesting development when weather goes nuts and when you're out in the middle of nowhere, you've no access to tillable soil. Another says, why is the Irish liberal left media continuing to climate shame Irish farmers? Oh. So, Ted, I have to say, I probably would be considered as a liberal left person. Agriculture is the largest contributor in terms of sector to climate change in this country. That is not anything to do with a farmer or farmers. This is the truth. It's a fact. And so talking about how we might mitigate that, how we might reduce that, is just it's just a fact. It's not I'm not shaming anyone. Like, you know, when farmers who are alive today started off in their careers, very few of them thought that what they do might actually harm the planet. Very many of them maintain the ground. They understand it much better than the rest of us. Only in recent years have we understood the full impact of particularly agriculture on the planet, but many other things too. And so explaining that these practices, some of them, are harmful, I suppose that's a responsible thing to do. I just don't get your argument, Ted. You know, if you pick out an individual person, it's one thing, but if you talk about the industry in general and the problems that it faces, I think that's what we have to do to make strides in something that is pretty bloody important. Olivia says, hello there, I'm a small-scale cut flower and veg farmer married to a cell biologist scientist. There's a lot of research to show that vegetables grown in natural sunlight are far higher in vitamins, hence much higher quality food. Take a look at Jean-Michel Fortier, The Market Gardener, great YouTube documentary and book. I spoke to Connor about that. I asked him about that. He said because you're not washing it, the level of nutrients you get from the food is actually better. I'm not a scientist. I can't measure those. Really interesting to see a side-by-side comparison, vertical farms versus natural sunlight. But there are some of the things he talked about were convincing in terms of arguments for vertical farms. Karen Hennessy said, really looking forward to hearing about this after hearing the promo. Currently setting up one of Ireland's first commercial hydroponic farms called Real Leaf Farm. Thanks very much for that, Karen. Another says, about vertical farms, look at all the greenhouses in Holland and around the world, growing our greens and flying them into us. This is the point. You could have a vertical farm in Inchicore, it would, you know, it could be the size or the equivalent of the size of a large farm, depending on, you know, and fit in the size of a factory. that's the potential of it. You've got water, you've got electricity, and that's all you need. And that is very exciting if you think about climate change, transporting these things, and also just the freshness factor. Like, God knows the disappointment I have opening vegetables that look okay until you open the bag and then you find they're turned to mulch. It's disappointing. So, I mean, I do see there are some serious benefits to it. We heard on the show last week, which is something I didn't realize, is that under the sea, bioluminescence is actually the default, and actually it's hardly any animals that don't bioluminesce. Someone at Ocean Ireland, Vincent, says, on many occasions I've been entertained by spectacular displays of bioluminescence while delivering yachts across the ocean, particularly amazing when dolphins are swimming through it, leaving laser beam type trails behind them. Yeah, it is something to behold. I saw my first bioluminescence on my honeymoon in the Maldives, and it was exactly like that. It looked like something from Star Wars trailing your hand through the water, and the bioluminescent algae. But actually, if you go down to Skibbereen, not far from there, you'll find they do kayak tours out on the lake, and at night you can see the bioluminescence and trail your hand through it while looking up at the stars. It's an amazing trip you should do. If you're ever in Skib, particularly over the summer, they do these amazing tours, but you need to book now if you're going anywhere near Baltimore or Skibbereen. Fab. B and D7 has said, great energy, great enthusiasm, but please stop asking everyone, how are you, at the beginning of every guest. It means the same question in return, and you telling guests and listeners several times per program that you're doing great. We don't need that, thanks. It's tedious. We know you're great, or great at faking being great. If that's your only complaint with the program, that's great. And a rise in human body temperature. And this is a conversation we had last week, that the standard core temperature in people has gone up in the past century, looks like. Joe says, what causes high blood pressure? Well, in over 90% of cases, the cause of high blood pressure, hypertension, is unknown. But several factors can increase your risk of developing the condition. I bet you can guess what they are. This is from the HSC website. They are, of course, age, high fat, high salt, lack of exercise, being overweight, smoking, drinking lots of alcohol, and stress. So, all the fun stuff. Known causes, about 1 in 10 cases of high blood pressure are the result of an underlying condition or cause, and they are secondary high blood pressure. They can be kidney disease, diabetes, narrowing of the arteries, taking the pill, lupus, which is a disease I'm only familiar with having inhaled every episode of House, which is the most formulaic drama based in a hospital you're ever likely to watch. This is how every episode of House goes. Open with an ordinary scene. Somebody you think is going to get sick, looks like they're going to get sick, and then switcheroo, it's actually someone else in the same scene who then suddenly gets very sick. They get brought to the hospital, and then it switches to House teaching his medical students something in an arrogant and obnoxious manner. The patient turns up. House dismisses it as something easy. The guys do go off and do their diagnostics and they treat it. Oh my God, that was what it wasn't. It only gets it worse. Cue to House looking really puzzled, an in-depth sort of blah, blah, blah montage. Then what happens is House gets inspired by something else that's happening in a second narrative in the story. So maybe he's tending bees or something happens. And then he goes, wait a minute, maybe the pincer of a scorpion is a bit like, and then transition to 10 minutes later, they're just about to apply this other treatment that they figured out by themselves, the diagnostic team, when House comes in and goes, stop, don't do that, you'll kill the patient. The patient starts to die, and then House goes, you should have used the pincer scorpion thing, and lo and behold, the patient's better. Finishes with a bedside scene where House is a prick to the patient, end scene. And that is every episode of House, but it's wonderful to watch.
It's deadly.
It is so good.
But it's a little like in James Bond, how like at the start of every James Bond movie, Q goes, I've got these four gadgets, and they just happen to be the exact four gadgets that Bond needs for that film.
Well, what's the, it's a rule in when you're writing film, I think Mamet said this, if you show a gun in act one, you have to use it by act two.
Foreshadowing, isn't that it?
Something like that, yeah. So if you see a gun, somebody's going to shoot that gun. God, we went off on one there, didn't we? On the podcast. Hi, I really enjoy the show. Think you're doing an excellent job. Thank you. I'm looking for one of your past shows, which is dedicated to decision making. Was it Jonah Lehrer?
I believe it was Robin Hanson, The Elephant in the Brain.
We do many, many, many on decision making. I think we had an Irish researcher, Redmond O'Connell, on decision making as well. We have done many of them, so I'm not quite sure which one it is. Any decision we make, we may be making unconsciously. You think it's who?
I think it's Robin Hanson, The Elephant in the Brain, which we did maybe 6 months ago.
Okay, well, have we responded to this person with a podcast?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's hope it was that one. You got it now, Igor. That was Igor Mensik. It was suggested that any decision we make may be made unconsciously, and as a case study, it used pictures shown to prospects and exchanged in the process. I don't know what that means. I'm sorry. But anyway, we sent you the link, so all is good. Another person says, why is there no gravity in space? But there is gravity in space, but it's very weak because things are very far away. But if you have even just a bit of dust, that dust has gravity. It's just big. Once you know, it's an attenuation thing. After a certain distance, gravity, like in the same way as we're stuck to the ground, but if we keep going higher and higher and higher, that force gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And if you're not near anything, there's nothing there to pull you, and so there is no gravity. But presumably, mathematically, everything is still pulling on you, just in ways you cannot measure. As you're asking that sort of a question, dear emailer, we will be doing something quite soon, but we'll be asking questions that you have in your brain that you haven't really ever found an answer to. They might be ungoogleable, or maybe the answer you found wasn't very satisfying. So if there is a question you would like us to ask the scientific community, no matter how ridiculous, you can email it to us, science@news.com. We'll be doing more of that and a bigger thing about it in the coming weeks. science@newstalk.com if you want to get in early and have probabilistically a higher chance of getting your question featured in the show, because we're quite lazy. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing, Simon Keane, who was researching, on sound with Jojo Cardozo. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious. Bye.